Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Thursday, which means it's time to hear from Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny. So joining us from McAllen, Texas is Tim Lynch. Tim, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Mac. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure. Jeff from Southern California. Jeff, how are you in that self-quarantine thing going?
It's good. I go to the field every day and I train Marines and then I quarantine myself when I'm done.
You know what? It's not a whole lot different than normal life.
Yeah, exactly right. It's pretty much normal.
Well, you know what? It reminds me a lot of either being deployed or shipboard life, where it's Groundhog Day, right?
Yep, shipboard life.
Yeah,
right.
But you had a gym on a ship.
You don't have a gym at your house?
No, I do not. I don't even have a pull-up bar, and I'm hurting now.
Oh, it's going to be painful, Timmy.
Yeah, I know.
When you go back?
Hey, when the shit hit the fan around here, all that stuff got sold out with the toilet paper.
Oh.
There wasn't a dumbbell around here to be had.
Oh, see, I just built mine about 6 months ago. I had some stuff, and then I bought more plates. I bought some dumbbells, and then I built a rack out of 4x4s and some hooks and shit. And so I got a treadmill. I got a bike. I'm set. It's like I'm on ship. I get on, or like I'm in Iraq or Afghanistan, where you're like, you just do the same things all the time. Then you come back. So yeah. It's like
I've got a stick with some cinder blocks on it, which means I look like somebody in one of those combat outfits that you guys had down in Southern Helmand.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it looks like.
That's not a good thing.
You're like a guy in the hood, Timmy, on the roof of the building. Next to the pigeon coop, you know what I mean?
I'm thriving in self-quarantine.
Yeah.
I navigate life better like this. It's like being deployed at home. And so if you can live on a ship, or if you can live someplace in some dirt patch in another part of the world, you can do this. So. Anyway.
Absolutely right.
We are going to continue a conversation about, you know, kind of trying to create a framework, you know, to dispassionately, to the best of our abilities, evaluate the Commandant's planning guidance, and you know whether we think it's good guidance for the Marine Corps or bad guidance for the Marine Corps. And so, so we're going to talk about an interview that. A couple interviews. One is Mark Kansian's interview. Mark at CSIS, retired colonel, prolific writer, all of that. And so so we'll start with his interview. Jeff, I know you had a chance to listen to it. Big takeaway from the Kansian interview?
Well, the big thing for me is, you know, I think I said this already, but I felt a little vindicated because I thought, you know, I don't see there's enough evidence to put your the emphasis of the Marine Corps the way the Commandant's guidance, you know, has come out. And because as I go through my knowledge of history, it comes that usually these guys aren't accurate with their prognostications of what the next conflict's going to look like. As a matter of fact, they've never been right. I mean, never. It's not just us. Nobody's ever right, unless, you know, they're going to be the ones who start it. And then, like you said, Mac, they only know how it's going to start. They don't know how it's going to end, you know? So it's like, that's the thing that jumps out at me is like, and then you go back in your mind and based on Kansian's, you know, comments, he's very cool headed, eloquent, non F bomb, you know, comments that he makes is that, you know, this doesn't work. And I think back to, you know, what happened to us after Second World War, you know, the true revolution there in military affairs, if you can call it, if there ever was one, was the advent of the atomic bombs, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the change that that would wrought. And people thought, we don't need to have this World War II type, you know, Marine Corps or Army anymore. And things, people got kind of complacent, and bang, Korea. And because of the politics, it became really clear in bas relief, as they say, that it wouldn't be appropriate for us to drop fucking atom bombs all over Korea. And so we had to get in there and fight, and we just weren't ready. And only by the grace of God, and they, as they say, a few Marines like General O.P. Smith and a few others, you know, did we manage to pull our ass out of the fire in that one. And but again and again, it's happened again and again. You get ready for one thing, and something else happens. I mean, what jumps to mind again, I know we're going to get into this a little bit later, but what jumps to mind is, you know, when President George W. Bush became inaugurated, and his Secretary of Defense, and, you know, and the folks he had working for him, smart guys, they were convinced that there's going to be a revolution in military affairs and things are going to change. And then we got hit with 9/11 and everything. It changed, but not the way they thought at all.
Timmy,
so that's what jumped out of me from Kansian's.
All right. Timmy, your thoughts on either anything Jeff said or Kansian's article?
No, and to respond to what Jeff just said, I continue to go back. I've mentioned this before, to what Jeff was doing on 9/11, which was in a car with a bunch of other officers driving down to an Army base to look at their FATS trainer. In other words, a training system replace having to shoot live rounds on the rifle range because the Army was finding that problematic. And that just went away that morning. I mean, when the second plane hit, the FATS trainer trip was forever forgotten. But looking at Kanchin's argument, okay, so we're talking about getting there to these island chains or being there ahead of time with ships and containers, assuming these ships are identified and made, and we have these containers, I think the deployment that TX Holmes was talking about, you know, arriving in a city and having these things disappear in local trucking and what have you, that's something I have considerable experience in, and you can't do it. That's not going to work. And I want to assume that they're throwing it out there as chum to because they've found places that they can do this with some degree of reliability of not being discovered, because throughout that archipelago of the Pacific there, on any island that has any type of infrastructure at all, you're going to find Chinese people. Sometimes there'll just be a few in some places, and it'll be a lot in your bigger, more densely populated areas. And with Chinese people in any concentration, to include in American universities, comes Chinese surveillance apparatus to watch what the people are doing, becomes also Chinese criminal gangs, tongs, to try to get that thing. So that the thought that you could go someplace and disappear as opposed to being a fixed base, to me, it doesn't sound realistic. And I want to think that what they're really talking about is they've identified places where they could sneak in and set up and then bamboos without many people seeing them, which maybe they have. I don't know. All I know is that the idea of foraging and all these things that he's talking about would imply falling in on some type of front that's already there that can get you this stuff. And the guy running the front has already has food and water and stuff like that, that is from a reputable provider, that's not going to get your guys sicker than hell. Because you think this coronavirus is something, wait till you get a good case of dysentery going through your ranks, or some Giardia lambi or something like that, that gets 100% of your guys down and out. I mean, that's why we go to such great lengths to fly in food to Afghanistan and stuff. So I see some significant problems with this. And I've not seen anybody say anything that would mitigate some of these issues, which are obvious to anybody. I mean, shit, we've all been through the Pacific. You know what the hell it's like there. Find a place where there's not Chinese people.
Well, and then if things were pointed in the direction of hostilities, you know, what would the Chinese do? They would surge their little green men, and they would put on civilian clothes, and they would wander around with their weapons and a coat over it, looking for Americans. And if,
yeah, and And it'd be a problem if they found them all holed up and setting up their missile tubes or whatnot, because those guys, all they're going to have is machine guns. Shit, even drug cartel. I mean, excuse me, all they're going to have is rifles. Even drug cartels have machine guns. So anybody's going to be able to mass enough combat power to put the hurt on them. Yeah.
You know, yeah, well, wait a minute. Till we shoot a tomahawk out their ass. Then you ever see a bunch
of guys that are 500 feet outside your wire?
Oh yeah, you ever see the tomahawk fired in the direct fire flechette round mode?
Oh no! Hey, I take it back. That would be awesome. I didn't realize what you were even talking about. But if we're in an area in which there are a mess of non-combatants. See, that's not going to slow China down. So they're following white trucks and they're looking at shipping containers. And we're assuming that they'll think that it's one of these 15 possibilities. They won't dare like hit all 15 and kill civilians. To which I say, what? It's China. Are you kidding me? So
Do you guys remember when 9/11 happened? The Army was General Shelton was saying we don't want to send our guys in there initially because there's no golden hour. I mean, it was the impetus for them sending in the 26th MEU and the 15th MEU under the command of General Mattis was to establish solid bases that people could operate from. I mean, they ended up sending guys in there anyway, but I remember, you know, there's a valid concern about, you know, the survivability of your guys, and to say we're going to have them forage and we're going to have them sneak into these places. It's just impractical to me, and I don't think they really do it.
The thing that jumped out at me from Kansian's interview was it made me really think about the lack of predictive success, the term he used. And that made me, you know, that made me think, you know, and so when I looked at, you know, and listening to him, when you think about that we're wrong, as Jeff said, not only we're wrong, right? I mean, you go, but there's, you know, again, Jeff's example of the Korean War. Yeah, we're not grunts and all the rest of this. Come on. We got nukes. Nobody's going to mess with us. We'll just tell them we'll nuke him. Well, we're not going to nuke him. You know, the French responded to a revolution in military affairs by constructing the Maginot Line. That revolutionized military affairs because they were simply, you know, going to construct this thing, right? That we tried to reconstruct in Vietnam, and they were going to deny mobility, and the fucking Germans went around it, you know. And
just like they went around it in Vietnam too,
right? And so, I just saw a picture in the vicinity of Cantien of one of those steel observation post that's still there. I can't even imagine being in one of those things when it got hit by an artillery round or a mortar round.
Yeah, Tim's dad calls it the trace.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I ever heard that term. The trace was the big, big fucking huge fire breaks they had to make to put this stuff in. And the battles that were fought over it, Operation Buffalo in 67 was because of the trace, you know. And if the trace would refuse its left flank, it might have worked a little bit better. But they're like, oh, no, that wouldn't be legal for us to go into Laos. You know what I
mean? Exactly.
It's stupid.
But but you hear all, you know, a lot of times in history, you know, you hear people predicting stuff.
They use the wrong historical examples all the time.
Right. And so to me, the other part that jumped out at me was, to me, disconcerting about the plan is that the Marine Corps is going to make cuts in, and is already doing it, you know, cuts in tanks, right? And we're going to make personnel cuts. The amphib that we're talking about doesn't even exist, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so there is, and there's no commitment from the Navy to build them in what quantity? So there's no commitment there. There's no commitment from the Army in terms of, you know, we kind of fairy dusted this shit, in my opinion. You know, we fairy dusted like logistics out of it. Oh yeah, Wolf Forage. Okay, got it. That's awesome. So we don't have to worry about that. And now, okay, if there's a heavy mech fight someplace, you know, that we need tanks. We'll get them from the Army. Well, the Army hasn't said, you know, we've got them for you. And this isn't the Army of pre the Berlin Wall going down. This is the post. This is the post Berlin Wall, the peace dividend. So there ain't a whole bunch of tanks hanging around. So you would have to get them out of the reserve, and that would take what, 90, 120 days, first to fight, no, maybe not.
Hey Mac, yeah. I got a saved round on the tanks thing. Because I've been thinking about that all week, and here's a question for you. Why the hell would you give a tank or tanks to any battalion that doesn't have the ability to generate combat power? It's offensive power. It's got no machine guns. It's got no mortars. It's got 600 rifle guys. What the hell is it they got, with no organic transpo? So how the hell are tanks going to help them? It seems to me that there's not even a question of them giving us tanks, because what are we going to do with them? We can't fight them anymore. We can't close with and destroy anybody because we've given up the offensive firepower to do so. That to me is the bottom line about the tanks. Who cares about tanks?
Let me just say this. So to me, Kansian's argument is pretty strong in terms of hedging. You have all this uncertainty, right? And then we could link it back to Marine Corps history and say the way we've always been a great asset to the nation is we have been, right, incredible bang for the buck. You're going to get more out of bringing Marines to the fight for less, because at some point you've got a budget that you're going to have to manage. Two, we're going to be there and we'll fight tonight. Three, we throw a thunderous right hook. And four, we're expeditionary. We could do it a whole bunch of different ways, right? And five, you know, we're flexible. If you need us to get heavy, we can put on weight. If you need us to shed weight and be light, we can do that.
Absolutely, right.
We do windows. So to me, all those things and the lack of any of assurances in terms of this style of fighting, the number of ships and all that, in my opinion, that forces you to hedge. And we're not doing that.
You know what, you guys, I have to tell you what popped into my mind today when I was thinking about this. Like, I picture in my mind, you got to go and brief General Berger on the throwaway COA for how we're going to get down to 154,000 guys and this much money. And the throwaway COA is this one. And Jeff, you guys argue, no, he's going to think I'm a fucking asshole. I don't want to do that. I got a reputation to think of. No, you got to do it, man. When he asked you about resupply, talk about foraging and shit. I'm like, fuck, I drew the short straw on this one. I would have been, knowing what I know, I would have been embarrassed, you know, to present this to him. That's the shocker of this, you know what I mean?
That he would have looked at you and you would have had to stand there in silence, right? Because you know,
he looked at me like I'm a 5'8" urine specimen,
right? And then you have to stand there and be the urine specimen, because the rule is when you're screwed, don't volunteer extra information. Make him ask you, right? So you stand there.
Foraging. The answer is foraging, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes. Did you just say, you know, Colonel Kenny, did my ears deceive me, or did you just say foraging? Yes, sir, I said foraging.
You mean like looking for shit? Yes, sir, like, you know, the Chinese.
No, don't volunteer. Hey, I got told by senior guys, don't volunteer any extra information. Make when you're screwed, make them yank it out of you.
Yeah.
Foraging. Yeah, right. Yes, sir. Foraging.
So that's what I mean. So it's kind of bizarre. You know, it's like hard to defend.
Well, yeah. That side of and it. Hard to take with a. Well, and again, with a straight face, yeah. Yeah. Right? Like, you know, where's the rim shot? Foraging. Yeah. Right? And so the other part is I think that Kansian makes a good point is the there's the rim shot. Is the use of the reserve. And so right. And so to me, the use of the reserve is where you can do the hedging And, you know, you can begin to, if, because I think, you know, most people would say, okay, there's got to be modifications to the MagTaf as we pivot to the Pacific. But shit canning the MagTaf, right? That's eliminating crazy. Eliminating your ability to close with, right? You know, and yeah. So I think, you know, so to me, that it made sense. And even if you said, you know, okay, there should be phases to this. In phase one, we begin this by doing these kind of things. Okay, I got it. When these things happen, right? When these ships actually get in the water, and when somebody says, yes, we're actually going to do this, then that would trigger this, right? Now, maybe I'm a simpleton, and I don't know enough about the way things get funded or the way things get procured. But to me, what you're doing is you're putting yourself as a service in a very, very vulnerable place and rendering yourself irrelevant across the range of military operations because you haven't hedged. And I think, I mean, that to me is a pretty dangerous spot to be in as a force.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Before we move on to Colonel Hammes's article, any other comments?
I don't know how many host nations within that Asian area are going to willingly allow us to come in either. I don't think we have the Philippines. Maybe we do. Maybe we don't. Well, hell, I mean, I listened to Grant this afternoon. He ran through it like we did last week. Although I'm more sanguine about Vietnam, I think the Vietnamese will let us come in.
He does.
That's about it.
Yeah, he doesn't.
I know he doesn't.
What Grant said as we went around the wheel. So if you go to Vietnam, he says doubtful. Down south, Malaysia, doubtful. Indonesia, doubtful plus. They don't like the Chinese. And so, but very integrated as all these nations are economically, right? And that was part of the
– So it's Taiwan.
Right. So, yeah, Taiwan. Yeah, there you go. Taiwan. And so and then the Philippines. Doubtful minus. Damn it. Right? And yeah. So that's the region, right, that's inside the weapons engagement area and it's inside the first island chain, you know, that some of this discussion centers on. So and so I thought Grant was absolutely spot on there. I mean, so to me those are more uncertainty injected into your single course of action that you're going to line up for the service. And so
it's even a question whether Japan would let you do that.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, unless Japan's already getting shellacked, there's even a question they'd let you pull that on Iwo Jima or Ishijima or any of those other little Jimas out there. It's ridiculous.
You're kind of already on Okinawa though.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are, but not without with those missiles that reach out and start shooting.
Let me tell you, when we shoot the Tomahawk flechette round in the direct fire mode, tell me, people aren't going to pay attention to that shit. All right, let's talk about.
It won't be as impressive as the old New Jersey. We're not bringing her back.
That's straight up, Colonel Hammes. To me, the number one point that he made was he believes, right, you know, I can hear him saying it, Mac, we're talking about a revolution in military affairs. So if you right? I mean, so if you listen to – it was interesting hearing him after Colonel Kansian. And I could hear Kansian saying our predictive abilities are horrible, as they are globally, right?
Yeah.
And so, Jeff, your thoughts on
– Well, my thoughts are – Colonel Hammes gets the Paul Wolfowitz Award for prognostication. I mean, pretty wrong. And, you know, those guys, I heard that Revolution Military. I went to, after I got done being the CEO of Pittsburgh, I went to command staff. And all I heard was, because it was just when George Bush got elected, and all me and Mel, I was in school at Mellinger and Kennedy and Killian, all we heard was that Revolution Military Affairs shit. And they were pushing that stuff that Rumsfeld and his little smart gang, Cambone and Wolfowitz and a couple other of these guys were pushing, none of them uniformed guys could give a shit about what we thought or what any military guys thought, you know, and it was all about lighting things up and fighting smart and all those other dumbass cliches. And, of course, 9/11 happened, everything changed. And they went the opposite way, you know, and but that's what Hammes.
Yeah, but they were still, though, the war plan that Wolfowitz, I mean, that Rumsfeld ultimately designs for Iraq is based on the principles that those guys, what was the guy's name? Doug Faith. Yep, he was one of them.
And it was horrible. I mean, we paid because, as we've talked about, there's no phase four. They poo-pooed the phase four thing. I guess they thought it would be like, you know, it'll every place was going to be like Poland and we were going to be the Germans in 1939, you know, or it's going to be like France in 1940 and we're going to be, you know, Guderian and Rommel, you know, ass whipping our way across there. And it would all, and then they would just meekly, you know, acquiesce once it was over. Well, they didn't. And those, and as you know, as we talked about earlier, General Van Riper was the op for when they did the initial planning and he kicked their ass because of the phase four. The Iraqis didn't feel like their asses were whipped. And I can tell you personally, they weren't, you know, and as we all know, they weren't. They, you know, there's a lot of fighting. We lost 4,000 guys dealing with the phase four shit. And, you know, so it's like, and if you listen to Wolfowitz now when he talks in public and Rumsfeld, there's no feeling of, yeah, we really screwed that one up. They have no, you know, and I get the same impression from Colonel Hams. He says, hey, this is the way it's going to go. It doesn't go that way. It's because somebody didn't cooperate. You know what I mean?
Well, that's what when you hear Rumsfeld in public and you hear Wolfowitz, it's like it wasn't executed well.
Yeah.
That's what they say. It's not that they were wrong. It's that the people and the circumstances and so this changed and this guy didn't respond appropriately. Had everybody responded the way we had scripted, then it would have all been nothing but ribbons and badges for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely right. And that's how I see Carl Hammes' thing.
Timmy, thoughts on revolution versus evolution of warfare?
Yeah. I get real nervous when I start hearing all this talk about it's all going to be containerized and portable within the existing. Because that's good. The containerized stuff. I remember when we first got the Hummers. Remember the Hummers and the Dragon Wagon? Right. And the whole selling point about that entire line of vehicles was what? That they were modular. You could rebuild them and repurpose them and blah, blah, blah. And that was great. It was a great selling point. In reality, not so much. The one thing that jumped out to me about Hams was it goes, you know, you've got these Marines. First off, his concept is we're already forward deployed on these ships that aren't built or designed yet that nobody's talked about buying. But we're all going to be out there, and let's assume that we are. Fine. And if we start by ramping up with economic sanctions and then China's got to do all their trading through Chinese boats and we'll have these Marines going around and seizing these boats and selling them in the world boat pirate court or whatever. That's insane. Why would we do that when we can just issue letters of marques to like, I don't know, Brown and Root for Christ's sakes, any one of these big companies, and they could go out there and seize ships all they want to and sell them in prize court. We don't need to be paying $1 billion for a Marine Corps to go do that. And the other point is we know that we won't be out there. We're not going to have rifle companies indefinitely floating out in the Pacific. But in that Pacific, the Chinese are there. They're already doing their warfare, their asymmetric warfare. They are targeting people. They are using money. They are using force. They are using every tool in the book to get their way. And so it's not going to be a case of rushing in before the Chinese get there. The Chinese are there. It's not going to be a case of responding kinetically because it's somehow and now being war because China is at war with us. They're making no bones about it. How many Harvard arresters professors have been arrested in the last few months?
Right.
I mean, they're just cleaning. Right. The Chinese are at war with us, and we're talking about answering their asymmetrical thrust with our own high-speed asymmetrical guys in coveralls and boats. And I'm telling you, the more I think of it, the more uncomfortable I get because I cannot see how that's going to work. I just don't see it.
And when faced with this, when faced with this tactic that we do, let's just say, what would they, I mean, how did anybody red cell this thing? What's going to be their reaction? I mean, you know, it's like the good thing about having a big 180,000 man Marine Corps that has AAVs and tanks, you know, and kludged in with fucking LHDs and LPDs and LSDs and shit, is that it's a fearsome thing. And, you know, if it comes at you, it's hard to deal with. I mean, you can't ignore it. You know, you can't fairy dust it. Is it that, you know, we're getting cut? If you want to forestall a bloody confrontation with somebody who has a lot of resources, you get yourself strong. You don't make yourself small. You know, that has an effect.
And the effect is you're going to be much, much quicker to loose the nukes. That's the goddamn problem. That's what we found out when we went nuke-centric before. Without a significant ass to go and grind it out on the ground, what are you left with? Well, hell with that. We'll send them a nuke. And that is not what we want to do.
Let me ask you a question. Does the Navy need us to do this?
That's Why the would they? Yeah.
Or is this us trying to write ourselves into a script that really – so if you look at the map and you look at the weapons engagement zone, I mean, we can engage ships from Guam. So what's the point of us putting Rocketeers, right, in Malaysia other than to write ourselves – I mean, I don't, and I, again, I'm not the smartest guy, you know, but I to me, some of it's a bit of a head scratcher in terms of, okay, so the Navy's got ships, right? And they have this architecture, and this is going to be a naval battle in that part of the world, if it ever happens, right? And so the Marine Corps is trying to write itself into this. If the Navy doesn't see us as a necessary thing in there, they won't fund us. They won't. I mean, they, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, they needed us in World War II because they needed us to seize, you know, advanced bases so that, you know, we could get across the Pacific and get to Japan. And we were a requirement. What will this be?
And remember, the Navy was ready to dump us in 47, just 2 years later.
Will this be a marginal player in the whole scheme of life, in terms of us trying? So again, I'm with you guys. When I hear revolution, you know, now again, based on the Cancian interview, I hear revolution. I'm like, can you prove that to me? Mm-hmm. And so it gives me the heebie-jeebies. And so if it is a revolution, how ought you, you know, to position yourself? And I think there ought to be a healthy skepticism that this is going to be right. And I think that's what we historically owe the Marine Corps, you know, if we're going to change it. There ought to be a healthy skepticism, and it ought to be a conditions-based, you know, evolution of the force. And not we're going to fairy dust stuff away. This stuff's got to be real, because the Marine Corps too important to the nation's defense to all of a sudden say, you know, yeah, we don't do windows anymore. And so I react with the same kind of, you know, I hear Buck Rogers. I was never a Buck Rogers fan. No. You know, all that science fiction, you know, shit to me. And now you have people like, see, I told you, Buck Rogers. It's like, no, that's not what you said. That's not what that was about. Right? That's not even close. Oh, yeah, this looks a little bit like that. But that's not what that was about. And so to me, there's always kind of a rush to do that. And so – I don't know. I got
another saved round on that, Mac, and that is how easy it is to defeat technology. That's a cycle that's as old as warfare itself. You come up with a new technology that you've invested a shit ton of money in. Okay, let us take, for example, in Iraq. We start getting roadside bombs. We put together smart guys. We come up with jammers, right? Now we got jammers at 25 yards. They can't jam us. We start jamming bombs. What do? They add another, 75 cents worth of comm wire onto their rig, and they get 50 meters out. And I mean, that's how they got Jeff, right? That's exactly how they got him. And that was defeating millions and millions and millions of dollars of technology with 50 cents worth of comm wire. The defeat of our our tactic here, I guess the tactic we're talking about, dispersing out and making multiple targets that are going to be hard to find. Not when you have 17 extra million dudes on your in your country, they're not hard to find. You can flood your islands with guys. They'll find you no problem. Plus, you know how the word travels within
To me, the first thing, and hence the importance of the Space Force, the first thing that happens is
– satellites.
Yeah. Everybody's satellites get whacked.
Right.
So solve the – like, okay, and I've said this before, but – you can go ahead and you have hypersonic weapons, right? But you can't – ships at sea, you can't target them because you don't know where the fuck they are anymore.
Right.
You can't see. So your point about this, is it a revolution or evolution? Artificial intelligence, all right, makes decisions at, you know, the speed of whatever, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what happens? Right. What happens when the AI goes? Where are they? We don't know. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And what they could tell you really quick is, well, we can't shoot then. And they'll tell you we can't shoot faster than anybody because it's artificial intelligence. If you can't tell me where they are, and so that's like the simple solution. Okay. So you could shoot a fixed target. You could knock Theodore Roosevelt's face off Mount Rushmore. Go ahead. Fucking do it.
Yeah.
Right. We don't give a shit. But
yeah. Well, I don't get, let them knock Thomas Jefferson's face off.
But how many times have you been cruising through the Pacific and there's not been a fishing boat or a trawler or something shadowing the arc? How many times? It's never.
Well,
they're always shadowing us when we're out.
I will tell you this.
You're going fast enough though, because they can't go that fast.
Yeah, when we were trying to elude them,
get away from the populated areas into blue water. Yeah, they're not going to find you. But you know
yeah,
I mean?
They would know that you left port. But when I was on the Ranger for 2 years, we got to Okinawa before they found us, and that was that was the Bear Deltas flying out of the reconnaissance aircraft flying out of Vladivostok that would look for us. So they'd hear that we'd left, and then we had a. We had the USS Long Beach, which was a nuclear-guided cruiser. And so we would go nose cold and sail southwest. And the Long Beach would turn on its nuclear afterburners and take a bunch of, destroyers. And then they all had, the Navy had these light arrays that they would drop. They're on poles, and they dropped them to the sides. And so the Long Beach would look like an aircraft carrier in terms of lights. Yep. And then what they would do is they would have an electronic, signature that simulated the aircraft carrier. And so
that's cool.
Yeah. And so
I never knew that.
Tactics there, man.
Yeah, that's old, Russian versus American,
yeah.
And we got across the Pacific without them finding it, without them ever locating us.
Right.
And
that's amazing. We used to do that shit. And, but if somebody was to shut down satellites, Macko, what you started talking about, they would use some kind of version of an EMP weapon.
Right.
And they would. We got to assume that they had targetry and stuff like that already doped out. They're not going to say, okay, now it's a fair fight. No, they're gonna already have figured out how they're gonna hit the fucking.
We need to bring. I need to get.
Teddy Roosevelt on the. On the Mount Rushmore, but the Teddy Roosevelt is floating out there. Is what they're
it's tied up at Guam right now because everybody's sick. Oh, and so to me, I've read that they're at that point there'll be lower based and lower orbiting satellites that get fired up that are disposable. We're going to regenerate this coverage over this area, and we're going to be able to regenerate that multiple times. And so I don't know enough about that. I should bring somebody on and interview them. But but to me, if that's the first thing that happens, right, then what?
Yeah.
Then we're back to, target acquisition is the biggest problem. We're back to coast watchers and human and those regular forces that are all over, the first island chain and shit, the second island chain too, out to Guam and shit.
You're right. It doesn't really lend itself to the HIMARS direct fire thing, whatever the hell this concept is going to be, for sure it doesn't.
Well, I mean, it makes you question, show me the footnotes, man.
Yeah,
Show me the footnotes that help get me there. And so to me, you know, when we hear the word revolution, and again, Colonel Hammond's, you know, much smarter than me, you know, and I got that. But again,
Don't bet on it, man. Don't bet on it.
Well, no, I mean, he's a smart guy. And and you know, and again, some of the stuff that guys like him told us in the 90s when they started talking about, you know, stateless adversaries and things like that, and we were like, what are you guys talking about? Like, what's a stateless adversary? This thing called Hezbollah, like, well, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, 2-8 knew a lot about Hezbollah.
Right?
After they-
right, but the rest of us didn't.
Yeah, I was going to say, I knew Hezbollah.
Right, and so we had to, you know, the rest of us had to learn. And so I'm not saying, so, but to me, this goes back to the Kantian interview of, you know, with uncertainty comes the necessity of hedging, right?
Yes, exactly right.
And so... So again, that's but to me, you know, the you hear things, and you're talking about, you know, reshaping the Marine Corps. Now here's the other thing about what Colonel Hammond said that I want to ask you about. Again, reshape the whole Marine Corps to a single fight. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I mean, yeah. Then the question you ask, okay, this is good. We're going to do this. Okay, what if it doesn't shake out this way, and a national emergency, you know, in a military sense with an adversary, you know, manifests itself in a different place in a different way. Then what? Can you guys shift? And if you can, how quick? And you know, and what will be the what are we going to lose? And to me, the answer is no. They can't really shift if they go this way.
Right.
No, how do you generate offensive combat power without machine guns and mortars? Right. I mean, you've taken yourself out of most every fight that I can imagine.
That flechette.
Only if you're fighting naked in Liberia.
You underestimate the flechette tomahawk in the direct.
Yeah, no, the flechette tomahawk. I got you, but I don't think you're going to have as many of them as you do. Machine gunners in a decent battalion setup. You know what I mean?
Shit.
Well, you don't understand the transformation of war, man.
I know.
You're hung up on the clothes-whip thing, man. No,
the problem is, though, Mac, like, the enemy might be dumber than us, and they don't understand it either. And these dumbasses keep their tanks and roll right over us.
Or
and we're like,
they don't,
as we're POWs, we'll be like, these guys, at least we know we're smarter than them, because we knew the Revolutionary War says that these things are no longer relevant. So when we got out of prison in 50 years, if we're lucky, you know.
A lot thinner.
At least we'll know we were right and they were wrong, even though they kicked our ass with their wrongness.
Yeah, if they decide that, war hasn't changed, and they, they're like, damn it. Like, what's that?
The enemy's not as smart
I think that's a fucking tank. What?
Yeah.
You're
not supposed to have those. Colonel Hammond promised us there wouldn't be tanks coming at us.
And they certainly wouldn't be decisive. Well, it's going to be decisive right up your ass. So let me before we wind this thing up. Let me just in this kind of, you know, construct to framework to evaluate. You know, we've talked about, you know, how this thing, the impetus of this is national defense strategy. Right. We talked about, you know, historically how people trying to predict future war have failed and how we always seem to, you know, not fight the war that we're preparing for, but we fight something else. We've also, we also try to look at this in light of, you know, historic Marine Corps abilities, and I think we talked about them. So one is be ready, and that's in line with first to fight. Be balanced, be expeditionary, and be cost effective. And then, you know, again, impact on historic USMC capabilities, no longer close with and destroy. Like, and you heard it in both interviews. It's like, oh, no way. And so, I mean, if you're not that, then you take away, I think, you know, the value of the Swiss Army knife, and then our abilities, right? Line companies reduced in size, no weapons company, no weapons platoon, right? No ability to absorb casualties and sustainment by foraging. So that fundamentally alters the complexion of the Marine Corps. The other thing I want to get you guys to comment on, and we have a kind of a little bit, but, you know, the Marine Corps has past commandants have behaved in a very similar way when they were faced with similar revolutions. Post-World War II, Jeff talked about the nukes, right? In the early 60s, you know, there was a movement to make the Marine Corps the low-intensity conflict or the counterinsurgency force. And the Marine Corps pushed back against that and said, no, we want to stay balanced. We want to stay conventional. And we were ready, you know, for Vietnam. Right. In the late 70s, you know, the Marine Corps resisted the urge to get too mech heavy, you know, to go to the fall to gap and stay balanced. In the 90s, there was another push, right, with special operations forces and, you know, wanting the Marine Corps to be the place where those, you know, that managed that whole lash up. And the Marine Corps pushed back on that, which is why we didn't really get in bed really at the start with special operations, and we went MUSOC, and that's how we answered the mail on that. And then Jeff talked about the Rumsfeld led reevaluation about 2000, but the Marine Corps again, you know, this whole thing with, you know, hey, it's going to be special operations, you know, precision guided munitions, blah 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 blah, and then 9/11 happens, and we're fighting a conventional war. Then we're fighting two counterinsurgencies, and the Marine Corps does well throughout because of its balance and because of its, you know, its expeditionary nature and because it's ready. So that's how historically commandants post-World War II, you know, have handled this. And that's going on 70 years of history. And so General Berger very much, you know, not following that script. And so we also talked about, you know, COA development, and does this have broad buy-in and whatnot. Right. And then we said, well, okay, so who are our adversaries? And the way you see it written about is 2, 2, and 1, or some people say, well, just 5, but it's China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and then non-state actors. Those are how you hear the adversaries defined. And then you hear most deadly course of action is China. Most likely is either North Korea, Iran, or non-state actor. Least probable is war with China. So China is most deadly, least probable, according to everybody that you read write about this shit. And then the other thing we've talked about is external commitments, you know, that are going to be required. And we don't have them. So the amphibious shipping requirement, we don't have from the Navy. Tank brigade, Army hasn't said shit about it. Right? Does the Navy see us as a vital piece of it? I haven't heard them say a whole lot about the Marine Corps. They're just kind of watching what we do, right? And then, you know, Timmy brought it up. Do we have guarantees from nations that will host, you know, this? And you know, according to everybody I've read, you know, it's a no right now. And you know, Colonel Hammond's talked about, you know, disappointment with the Trump administration and the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the diplomatic relations with some nations and all that. So, by anybody's definition, that's problematic. So, those are external commitments that are required, and then also the role of the reserve as we evaluate this thing. You know, so according to Colonel Kansian, the reserve is the thing that allows you to hedge. And, you know, we also talked about, well, how about a conditions-based migration, you know, to whatever we become in the Pacific? That when these things happen, that triggers these things, and that the reserve is part of that. And so, but so far that's kind of been, you know, undefined. So that's kind of the framework that we've tried to build as we, you know, as we watch this thing come to market. And any thoughts on that before we get final thoughts, boys?
I do. I have thoughts on that exactly. What you talk about, special operations forces, vice conventional forces, and people saying we should go this way or that way. What they're failing to remember or to realize is that those forces work best complementing each other. Not we're going to go all tanks, we're going to go all, you know, special forces, we're going to go all conventional. They're designed to complement each other. Just like the way combined arms is meant to complement, you know, the force, so that you know, success can be achieved. Because the enemy is not just he's not just a monolith thing out there. He's a thinking, breathing, reacting person, you know, entity that's going to react to us and maybe even be proactive to us and cause us. Usually, the United States is not the aggressor in these things. So that's a key thing to remember that. When you give away everything and put your eggs, you know, you put all your chips in one block, you destroy your flexibility. And if history's shown anything, and it's shown this over and over again, we've always, not just us, but everybody always guesses wrong about the nature and sometimes even the location of the next fight. And I would say this, you know, I talk to a lot of folks.
Most of the time, yeah. both nature, yeah. They're wrong on both nature, yeah. and location.
Yeah, I mean, for all we know, you know, Cuba could seize, you know, one of the Virgin Islands for one reason or another. What the fuck would we say? We'd be like, are you shitting me? You know, I know that was the attitude towards the grenade operation. What? You know, but there it is. And how are you going to deal with it? And we had the flexibility because, you know, we didn't have all our eggs in the mech basket or in the, you know, the special ops basket, you know, or the counterinsurgency basket. We dealt with it. And this is before we had the official moniker of, you know, the MUSOC battalions. This was a regular old med float getting ready to go to Beirut. And, you know, so that lesson should be like a bellwether for people who are making plans now, because that is, there's no big change in history or anything like that that points to, you know, a different type of possibility in the future. Not at all. The opposite is true. You know, the opposite is true. The rise of the internet and the massive, you know, ability of people across the globe to connect with each other makes, you know, unexpected conflicts more likely, not less likely. And the ability to just think it's going to be in one theater at one time, it's just not bought by a lot of people. And everyone's waiting for more info. I mean, I work, you know, on base, and I'm easy to find. I know a lot of people, and they talk to me. And, you know, they're perplexed by this thing. Like, what is this? What's the, you know, what's the, where's the chapter two to this thing? Where's the part that convinces us? Because I don't know anybody, and I know a lot of people, I don't know anybody who agrees with this, you know, active duty or retired. They're all got a big question mark coming out of their gourds. What is going on and why? And what's the, you know, can we please get a little bit more selling point on this? You know, like, why are we doing this? That's what I'm getting.
I get the same thing. I have people call me. Yeah, and we know. I mean, Jeff been in the Marine Corps forever. You know, I've been around the Marine Corps since 1983. And Timmy, when did you join the Marine Corps? We lost Timmy. But you know, kind of what I go back to is the Michael Gordon article, and you know, and you there's so many questions about what the comments.
I think Tim got commissioned in 85, though. Just to
so put it about in. Then the yeah about then. So I go back to the Michael Gordon article, and I'd make a couple points about it. One is Michael Gordon's one of the most respected writers of military things in the world. There's a reason why that story was given to him, right? And because obviously trying to trade on his credibility and what he would write about it. And mm-hmm. So when he says, and I quote from the article, some retired Marines cautioned that too heavy a focus on China may make the Corps less flexible in dealing with conflicts that might erupt in the Middle East and other distant regions, which they consider to be more likely. Now, when he writes that, let me explain that to you. That means that the general officers that he knows, and he knows all of them, right? And he's much respected. Not one of them would go on the record with him and talk to him. It also means that none of them went on the record to be supportive of the commandant's plan. Now, right. To me, that's not in the article, right? No. I mean, you have to think about it. And that there's not one retired general officer that's quoted in the article saying, hey, this is great. I think General Berger's spot on. So to me, that's a little bit disturbing. And then here's the other thing. Generals don't take each other on in public. Okay? They hardly take each other on in private unless it's small group, closed room. Okay? Right. Because that's not how the Marcus Queensberry rules work when you're becoming general. So Gordon asks Zinni a question. Here's the only quote. And here's Zinni's response. And I quote, "I think it's a mistake to organize yourself in a way to go after a specific region. Something could happen tomorrow with the Iranians. The answer is to be ready, expeditionary, and balanced." Now, ready, expeditionary, and balanced, that's what commandants have steered the Marine Corps through, right, since World War II. In all these, you know, hey, we got nukes, we don't need this. Oh, we're special operations, we don't need that. The Marine Corps has always been pretty steady, right, modified itself, modified its equipment, but ready, expeditionary, balanced, and the most bang for the buck of any service. Now, for General Zinni to say that, to be quoted in this article, I mean, that's kind of a gentle – he doesn't comment on General Berger. He doesn't say anything about his course of action. He just makes a general statement. That is a gentle nudge, right? That's a gentle nudge. That's the only quote from a general officer in this thing. And I think it's pretty illustrative, right, of the concern that I think a lot of Marines have, whether you're on active duty or you're retired or you've been long retired, right? People read these things and they just wonder, like, what's going to happen to the Marine Corps if he's wrong? And so, I think that's legitimate. And so, to me, one of the interesting things about doing it, you know, what we're doing, is on a weekly basis as articles get written, you know, bringing authors on, and then we'll get a chance to talk about the things that they say and then bring them back here and really kind of, you know, build out our framework and at some point, in my opinion, deliver an opinion, you know, either collectively or individually, on what we think of the commandant's idea. I mean, and we're still building the case for that. But, I mean, that's what the framework's about. Timmy, yep. Final thought?
Yeah, my final thought is this, Mac. Maybe it's going to be possible once this is all explained to us that we can see that this is the right move. Maybe. I don't think so.
Well, but again, I would say to you, we all understand the need to pivot to the Pacific. We all understand the need to recock to be able to take on China. Everybody understands that.
Oh no, I'm talking about about how he's cutting the exactly. forces, how he's reorganizing
right.
the forces.
Right.
And that specific issue is going to be an emotional issue to the Marines. And this is the one thing that I don't understand and that I've got to be critical right up front, even though I don't know what the commandant knows. I do know he should have prepared the Marine Corps better for this kind of a lightning bolt from Mount Olympus coming down and killing every friggin' tanker and half the grunts and everybody else. Obviously, we've been through this retiring battalion colors and bringing them back. Because I was in 1-8. Both those battalions apparently are going to be gone. But and we get that. But when you talk about all your tankers, most your tube artillery, machine guns, no machine guns or mortars in the rifle battalions, that kind of change, I think, should have been handled better. Because I can't imagine what the Marines on active duty are thinking right now, particularly tankers. I would be more than a little crushed were I them, because it ain't like they don't love the Marine Corps too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know? The kid who was running the convoy today was like. I don't know what I'm going to do. Tanker.
Yeah. And so it should have been prepared better, assuming that there is an argument to be made that we will all, once we understand it, give credence to. I don't think so.
Okay. Let's do a quick informal poll. Just where we're at. Okay. So both of you, you both know general officers. Let's talk about, you know, active duty general officers. Anybody you know support this?
No.
Me neither. All right, let's talk about retired guys. We all know retired guys. Any retired general officers, senior officers that you know support this?
This news is so upsetting to my father that my stepmom is making a concerted effort to shield him from it. That's how his reaction was to it.
Yeah. I get calls now, people scratching their head and say, "Hey, right. I know you follow this. Explain this to me." And yeah. I say, "Okay." And I explain it to them. And so I don't know. So to me, when we look at, you know, by everything we've heard, this was developed in a small group. And now it's been delivered to the Marine Corps. And now people get told, all right, everybody, time for everybody to get on board. And if you, as to kind of emphasize Timmy's point, if you want broad-based support, that's not how you do it.
Right. No.
So maybe they don't want, maybe they don't care. I mean, that would be really disturbing, you know?
Well, what are you left to assume?
I mean, well, but again, I mean, developing it in a small group, that's how, you know, General Gray, right, you know, maneuver warfare was small group at one point, and then it went, I don't want to say viral, but then it went to everybody, and we argued about it. General Krulak did the same thing. You got to start out in a small group. You got to refine the idea, right? And then, boom, you launch it to everybody. It's right. Just, to me, the people, I don't know. I, you know, substantive people, you know, when they're incredibly concerned, and again, I haven't spoken to General Zinni, but when you read his quote,
says it all.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a gentle nudge in public, which general officers don't do. You know, and you know, I call General Zinni the burning bush for a reason. Right? And I think he's the best. And both in uniform and out. And again, very restrained, very polite, you know, not openly critical of the commandant, just saying, hey, here's what I think about the way the Marine Corps should be. And so anyway. All right, boys. Well, first of all, I appreciate it. Go ahead.
I got one last thing, Mac. I got to get a shout out to Lieutenant Colonel Ty Edwards, USMC retired. Hey, Ty, I appreciate you looking after my dad during this COVID-19 thing. I very much appreciate it.
Ditto that. Ty Edwards is a solid citizen. So this is from Jeff Kenny. Hey, Ty, good luck, man. Hope you're doing good.
And you can find an interview with him. All you got to do is, you know, search the website for Edwards, EDWARDS, and you'll see an interview with Ty. And his story is a great story. Timmy, you have a friend of yours wrote a book.
I'm sorry, buddy.
A book about mortuary affairs.
Oh, not a friend of mine. No. I heard this gunnery sergeant on the Jocko podcast. I mentioned that to you guys earlier. And I don't have the book right in front of me.
All right, never mind.
Let's
some other time.
For next week. I'm sorry.
That's all right. All right. Yeah. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
No worries.
And again, we love the Marine Corps, man. And what we try to do is host a pretty open-minded liberal arts discussion about what we read, right, what we hear, and hopefully, you know, the clouds will part and the sun comes out and somebody says, here's how it all makes sense, boys. But none of us have seen that yet. And it's if I could make one comment that I think colors all of us, and that is extremely concerned about becoming irrelevant in a future conflict. And then people say, you know, we really don't need them.
Right.
We really don't need them. So I think you have a lot of very, very concerned people about the future of the Marine Corps. So
I have to tell you, Mac, I had a talk with a retired sergeant major who's now a contractor like myself today. He said, you know what? I hear this stuff and some of the other stuff that happened over the last 5-6 years. I'm thinking maybe it's time for us to go. He said this to me. This guy is one of the hardest guys I know. He said, maybe it's time for us to go away. So at least when we go clean. And I'm thinking, what
exactly what my dad said
to the nation, you know?
Wow. I can't even imagine guys thinking that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. All right, boys. Thanks for the visit.
Hurrah.
Night, brother.
So you have it. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.